All right, so Rayim Tovim, everybody. Erev Tov in Israel. Good afternoon on the East Coast. Good morning on the West Coast. Hope everybody's doing well. As we welcome to this extra special shiur after completing our series, Shuli, we're going to do a special, Pesach series on the Exodus and archaeology, Paro's heavy heart. And so we look forward, always exciting, interesting, and packed with information. And I do really want to thank Shuli for all her teaching and efforts. And please, God, we will resume. The earliest will be after Shavuot, not during Pesach and Shavuot for sure. And really, I want to thank you for your erudition and your presentation and your interest in the fascinating, pictures and everything that goes with it. And thank you very much. And okay, I'll make my announcements now. As you say, the few announcements this evening, Rabbi Nadi Helfgott, 8:30 p.m. from the Tivat HaShalom in Pinak, will be giving our Parshat HaShavuot here. Tomorrow morning, we'll be finishing up, I'm finishing up this unit on my shiur on the Sidur. Actually, we'll be talking about, it's going to tie into Pesach, coincidentally, but of course there are no coincidences. And that's tomorrow at 9 a.m. Rabbi Liebtag, 11:15, Tehillim and Magid. And then next week, sort of, Mark Shapiro will have his regular class. We'll have a few of our regular classes. Moshe Sokolow will have his regular class. And we'll have maybe an added class on Pesach or two. We'll keep you posted by email. And we look forward to learning with you. And as always, invite a friend. And want to wish everybody, if I don't see you before I hear from you, I want to wish everybody Chag Kasher V'Sameach, all the best. And we should hear good news and good things. And B'nissan Nigalu, B'nissan, please God, the Aitidim Ligael, we should have at least, if not the full redemption, the closer steps to the redemption. Okay, Bakasha, that's lots of announcements, Shuli, more than I thought. So it's all yours, Bakasha.
Okay, thank you so much, Rabbi Kalman. Thank you, everybody. So I'm glad you all took a break from Pesach cleaning. If you're doing any Pesach cleaning, I was very happy to take a break. And we are going to talk about Paro, Exodus, and archaeology. Okay, basically, we're going to do two things, actually. This is a two-part class. Okay, the first part is exactly what it says here, right? The background from Egypt, the religion, how it connects to the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim. And the second shorter part, a little bit about the Seder and the land of Israel and what that teaches us about how we do our Seder today. Okay, so that's the two parts. So the question basically is here, right? As believing people, of course we say Yetziat Mitzrayim. Of course we say the Exodus has happened. It's a very foundational belief. Some people here may remember that about, I don't know, 20, maybe it was even more than that years ago, the rabbi in California, Rabbi David Wolpe, very well known, reform, reconstructionist rabbi, who talked about how it's a symbolic idea. It's not important if the Exodus happened, but that is very untrue for traditional Jews. The Exodus is the reason that we become Jews. God takes us out. We create a covenant with him. It is a very, very important event. And therefore, the historical accuracy of the story is a big deal. Now, up until relatively recently, no one doubted this story in a serious way, right? First of all, why would anybody invent such a terrible past? Why would a people invent such a terrible past about themselves? Conservative rabbi, thank you. Sorry, sounded reform. And why would somebody invent such a terrible past? And something so central to the identity of the Jewish people, how could you invent such a thing? However, in the last few decades, there have been doubts that have been raised, both from archaeology, from biblical scholars, and other places. If this is something that interests you, by the way, there are a few places that you should look for more information than you're going to get in this short class. Number one is Rabbi Dr. Joshua Berman, who has written books about this and articles. He just actually brought a trip from Israel to Egypt to talk about the Egyptian roots of the Exodus story. Another person very, very interesting, a Rav in Yeshivat Haratzion, Rav Amnon Bazak, has written a book called Ad Hayom Hazeh, Until This Day. It's been translated into English, where, among other things, he deals with the issues of archaeology and evidence or lack of evidence for the stories in Tanakh. So there's some of what I'm going to say here is going to come from there, from each of these, but not only. The best example that I can think of for a contemporary doubting of the Exodus story, a few years ago, the Israel Museum did a fantastic exhibit that they called Paro in Canaan, which was basically about the time period between around 1750 BCE and about 1450 BCE, time period where the Egyptians rule in the land of Canaan, from Paro to Tutmos and on. We're going to talk about that. It's going to be important for us. And they talked about Egyptian influence on the land of Israel and Egyptian styles and Egyptian gods. And as you went through the exhibit, you came to the exhibit that was supposed to be about the Exodus. And as you walked into that room, you were rather surprised, perhaps, to discover that the room was empty. And it was empty except for a film that had various scholars talking about the Exodus, meaning, of course, there's no artifacts to show here because there's nothing to know, right? There's no story here. And to me, that was a very, very upsetting. And we're going to see that there really is quite a lot to know. And even if you don't need any proof and you have faith, and that's amazing and wonderful, knowing the background to the story makes the story much, much richer, as we're going to see. And we'll give you something to say at your Seder, I hope. Okay, so just to start off with this picture, very important to note, the Jews did not build the pyramids. Right? There's a famous story about Menachem Begin when he's talking to Anwar Sadat, you know, this is the time of the peace talks, and he talks about, here we are, we built these pyramids, and some, you know, advisor of him is like nudging him in the ribs, Mr. Prime Minister, we didn't build the pyramids. Okay? The pyramids are at least 1,000 years earlier than the story of Am Yisrael in Egypt, but, you know, it's kind of nice shorthand. We didn't build the pyramids. We didn't build the Sphinx. Okay, so just keep that in mind. Doesn't mean we didn't build other things, but we did not build that. Okay, let's take a quick look at a timeline. This is obviously a very, very, very shortened timeline. Egypt is the gorilla in the room in the Middle East. Egypt has been, always will be, still is, very, very powerful. Even in periods where it wasn't so powerful, it was still one of the bigger powers in the Middle East. It has hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of years of history. We are just going to highlight a few elements that are significant to our story. Okay. So let's just look at a few different things. Starting from about 4,000 years ago, right? We have the Middle Kingdom. Egypt is united. Egypt is made up of Upper and Lower Egypt. Upper Egypt, perhaps counterintuitively to those of us who look at the map, Upper Egypt is in the south. Lower Egypt is in the north, right? It depends on the topography and the Nile spilling out into the Mediterranean. They were two countries and they become united. The capital is in Thebes and it's a very strong economy. Around this time period, we have something called the execration texts, the Kitvei Me'erot. And this is a belief that if you write a curse about various places, that if you write it down, sometimes if you break the tablet, the curse will come true. So you have curses on all sorts of cities and among them many Canaanite cities. From 1650 to 1540, we have this foreigner people called the Hyksos who rule over Egypt. Some people have suggested that the Hyksos are us, are the children of Israel. It is extremely unlikely that that is so, but that was like a popular theory for a time. Okay? By 1540, the Hyksos are kicked out. The Egyptian rulers come back. By 1480, Thutmose III conquers a lot of land of Canaan, and we're going to talk about this idea and the importance of Thutmose and of what he does to Eretz Canaan. Religious reform. Okay. Paro Akhnaton wants to have only one god, the sun god, as opposed to, as we'll see, the very large pantheon of gods that the Egyptians have. And important to us, he moves his capital to a city called Amarna. Now, Akhnaton is not around for a very long time. The capital does not stay in Amarna for a very long time. And when the capital is moved, there are some letters that are left behind that are discovered many, many years later by archaeologists. We're going to talk about them, the El Amarna letters that show us the ties between the Canaanite local rulers and the Egyptian Paro. So the capitals move back to Thebes by 1300 with Ramses the First. Ramses the Second, as you can see, rules for a very long time, is a very powerful king. We are going to suggest, many scholars suggest, that this is the Paro of the Exodus. Okay. And perhaps a little anticlimactically, in 1213 is the first time we see the name Israel outside of a biblical text. Okay. We see the name Israel on something called the Merneptah Stela. This is around the time of Joshua, around the time, well, a little earlier, around the time of the Exodus and wandering in the desert, right? Especially if we see Ramses as the Paro of the Exodus. And by the 1180s, Egyptians begin to lose control over Canaan, and the Israelites, as well as the Philistines, who are not the subject of what we're talking about today, move in. Okay, so that's just to give us kind of a bigger picture. Our focus is on the time of the Exodus, right? So from around 1300 till around 1200-ish, okay? And all of these dates are questioned, and we're not going to go too deeply into the dates. Okay, a little bit about Egypt before we get to our story of the Exodus. One of the most important revolutions in human history is the idea of the alphabet. Right. Very, very, very significant, because up until then, at least we're not talking about, you know, China and those countries, we're talking about in the ancient Near East. How did people read and write? There were two ways to do that. You either had hieroglyphics that I assume many of us are familiar with from Egypt, pictograms, right? A picture for each word or each name or sometimes a whole syllable. Or you had cuneiform, right? Those things that look a little bit like chicken scratches on clay. Same idea. Shapes for each idea, concept, word, right? In order to become literate, particularly with hieroglyphics, you have to learn thousands of them. And therefore, literacy was really reserved for the elite, either for people who made this their profession, right? Scribes, priests, or for people who had time, you know, kings, wealthy people. But there's no way that the average person could become literate. It was just too difficult. Okay? About 1800 BCE in a place called Serabit al-Khadem in the Sinai, and we'll talk about who discovers this place and excavates here, there are a group of slaves who start to develop some form of an alphabet. Now, what does an alphabet mean? An alphabet means that instead of a picture for every word, you have a picture for every sound. Okay? There are a very limited number of sounds that the human tongue can make. 22, 26, 30, right? And then you take those sounds and you combine them into literally an infinite number of words. Everybody can learn 22, 26, 30 shapes. So everybody can learn how to read and write. And this is an enormous, incredible revolution, okay, happening before we get the Torah, right? So there is a literate society already by the time we get the Torah. What's going on? Why does this happen? And who are the people who discover it? So these are one of the archaeology power couples. Okay? The gentleman is named Flinders Petrie, and his wife is Hilda. They are very far from a typical British upper class couple. Whoever you are, please mute you. Here, I'll mute you. That's the end of that. Okay. They are very far from anything that you would imagine. They become archaeologists. They're both archaeologists, actually. Flinders Petrie, we're going to talk about a little later when we talk about the Merneptah Stela. His wife, Hilda, is actually the one who they dig in Serabit al-Khadem. They discovered there were mines there. And the slaves who worked in the mines figured out a simple way to write their names as well as various other things. Why? Because there's a temple in Serabit al-Khadem to the goddess Hathor, one of the Egyptian goddesses, and the slaves wanted to be remembered to Hathor, right? Think about a job working as a slave in a mine in the Sinai Desert. You don't have a lot of prospects, right? Basically, all you can look forward to is the afterlife, and the goddess has got to remember you so that you make it into the afterlife. So they figure out a way to kind of simplify a few hieroglyphics and to create an alphabet, okay? And she's the one who discovers it. This alphabet kind of goes underground for a while, and it only becomes more widespread around the 13th century with people called the Phoenicians. Okay? Phoenicians today in what today is called Lebanon. They are actually Canaanites. And they are the first ones who start to really popularize this alphabet. But of course, the Canaanites use it and the Israelites use it. And it's all the same basic alphabet. So the alphabet comes from these slaves down in the Sinai Desert. And that's just interesting, not connected to our Exodus story, but interesting to think about nonetheless. Okay, let's talk about the historicity of Yetziat Mitzrayim. Okay, so scholars will say that there is no proof for Yetziat Mitzrayim will say, first of all, there's no record of us in Egypt, which is a pretty strong argument, you would think, right? There's no record that the Egyptians have Israelite slaves. The only time we hear about Israel at all is with this Merneptah stela, and even there, they talk about how we've been destroyed. Okay? We have no finds in the Sinai, right, that show that these people traveled through the desert for so long. So there's no written evidence, there's no archaeological evidence. Okay? However, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. This is not my phrase. It's a very famous phrase. Okay. We have not found it yet. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Now, there are various reasons why the Egyptians would not write about the story of the Exodus in their annals, as we know from the Torah. The story of the Exodus is all about the humiliation and the defeat of the Paro, right? And the story is all about how Egypt is visited by these terrible plagues and awful disasters happen to them. And as we know, rulers, whether ancient or modern, don't like to talk about their defeats. They like to talk about their victories and their successes. And in the absence of a free press, who's going to be writing about this, right? The official records are not going to be writing about this. The fact that we have no archaeological evidence in the Sinai is also not much of a proof. Nomads do not leave behind houses, temples, right? They're moving on. It's very, very clear from the Torah that this is something temporary, that they move from place to place. Even the most important structure, the Mishkan, the tabernacle, is movable, right? You take it apart, you move it to the next place. The arguments for the historicity are that we have many, many, many details that ring true and would only be known by somebody who was deeply immersed in this culture. Okay, we're going to see a whole bunch of them, but I'll give you a few examples that we're not going to see. Right, first of all, it's very clear that the Egyptians enslaved foreigners, that we know about from their annals. We hear in their records about the idea of brick quotas, right? The story that we have in Shmot, where the Paro says you have to make X amount, and now I'm not even going to give you the straw to make the bricks. So this idea of a brick quota, very much an Egyptian idea. There are names that we have in Egyptian slave records that occur in the story. For example, Shifra, Pua, right? The midwives. Those names are names that we have in Egyptian slave records. Word Moshe means a child. We have this very nice derivation in Hebrew, min hamayim mishitihu, I took him out of the water, but it's actually an Egyptian word that means child. The concepts, right? The concepts of a nursing mother coming to raise a child, right? Words that are used in the story are Egyptian words, the yor, zefet, right? The tar or gomer, the reeds. We have evidence that the route that God does not take them on, Derech Eretz Plishtim, right? That route that goes directly up from Egypt to the land of Israel was very fortified. Entrances and exits were watched. No one left without permission. One of the strong opponents of the idea that the Exodus is real, right? Somebody named Professor Yisrael Finkelstein, a very important and distinguished biblical archaeologist, but he doesn't think this is a story that has any proof in fact. He says, we know that the Egyptians really fortified all the exits out of Egypt, and the only way you could get out would be with a miracle. Exactly, right? Exactly. That's the story. We get out with God's hand. And the reason that I brought this nice picture of the Seder plate, right? And the Zroa over here, right? We talk about with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. Yad Chazaka Zroa Netuya. This is used to describe the strength of the Pharaoh. The strength of God, excuse me, but in Egyptian texts, it is used to describe the strength of Ramses, of Paro Ramses. Paro Ramses has a strong hand and an outstretched arm. What the biblical text is doing is subverting, is taking, you think you have the strong hand, the outstretched arm. We're going to see this all through the story. No, no, no. It's not you who has it. It's God who has it. So now let's go a little bit deeper into the symbols that when we read the story, we don't think so much about them. them. But once you know about ancient Egypt, suddenly these symbols take on much, much stronger resonance. Okay, so let's start with the staff, right? When you think of Moses, from the beginning of his career and up until the end of his life, what is he always carrying in his hand? His mate, right? His staff. Probably because he's a shepherd, he has a staff. But God says to him, take your mate, kach et matcha. Take it with you when you go to Paro. Why does he always have to take it with him? Why is this what he uses, right, to do all kinds of miraculous things? Because the staff, as you can see in the pictures here, I'll highlight it. The staff is the symbol of power in Egypt. Every ruler is depicted with a staff. Without a staff, you don't have power. Okay, the staff is your symbol of power, and Moshe needs his own staff. You have a staff, I have a staff too. You think you're powerful, right? I have power as well. This is called a was scepter. It has a stylized animal at the head, at the top. Okay, now if you recall the story, what does Moshe do with his mate, with his staff, right? What he does is he turns it into a snake. We're going to see the animals are very, very important in the Egyptian pantheon. Many gods are represented by animals. Okay. One of the most ancient goddesses is the goddess Wadjet. Okay. She is the protector of Lower Egypt, and she is symbolized by a cobra. Okay. Cobra, very, very powerful. And many of us have seen on the headdress of the Paro, here is this cobra. Wearing it on your crown means you are a legitimate ruler. Moshe coming with his staff, turning it into a snake. You have a staff, I have a staff. You have a snake, I have a snake. Right? We are speaking in a language that Paro understands. Does God need a snake or a staff? Of course not. But how is Paro going to know that God is a powerful God? By speaking to him in the language that he knows. Okay. Another God or another metaphor that we hear about in the story is about the Tanin, right? The crocodile, right? In the book of Ezekiel and Sefer Yechezkel, we have this great imagery, right? Almost a monologue to Paro, right? Where God says to Paro like this, right? What does he say to him? You can read it in the English on top, but in the Hebrew, it says, Va'amarta daber va'amarta ko amar Hashem Elokim hineni alecha Paro melech Mitzrayim hatanin hagadol harovetz bitoch ye'arav. You great crocodile sprawling in the Yaor. Asher amar li yaori v'ani asitini. The Nile is mine. We're going to see the Nile is very important. And I have made it for myself. Okay. Now, another god, as well as a connection to Paro, is the god Sobek. He's really creepy looking. Okay. Those of us who read Lyle the Crocodile when we were little, this is not such a friendly crocodile. Okay. This is the crocodile god Sobek. It's also a very, very ancient god. And Paro is his incarnation, right? That's why we have this great picture here of the Paro, but with the head of the crocodile. Crocodiles are very much feared animals. We're going to see a crocodile in the Book of the Dead soon. They're terrifying. They're very, very frightening. But they're also objects of veneration. Okay? And this picture here on the right, this is an amazing picture. This is a mummy of crocodile. Okay? The Egyptians did not mummify only people. They mummified animals that they felt were very important. We have mummies of ibis birds. And here's a mummy of a crocodile. It's an object of veneration. And again, right, the same language. In Shmot, right, in Shmot Perek Zayin, I didn't bring it for you here, but in Shmot Perek Zayin, we have the Tanin who comes to eat the other Taninim, right? Let me just find it for you. Sorry, shouldn't have closed my Tanakh. Okay. Hashem says to Moshe and Aaron, take your staff, turn it into a crocodile when you throw it in front of Paro. And the other ministers, the other magicians, they also turn their staffs into crocodiles. You know magic? We know magic too. But then, Paro, Aaron's crocodile, eats the other crocodiles. Again, symbolism that is very, very potent, that works for the Egyptians. Now, the Makot, and there's all interesting kinds of interesting studies about the Makot. We're really only going to talk about the first one, about the Nile turning into blood. The idea of the Makot is that the Makot, the plagues, hit the Egyptians where it hurts most, whether it's with their gods or with their livelihood. And the thing that hurts the most for the Egyptians, okay, maybe not like the Makat Bechorot, like the firstborn, but something that is exceedingly important is the Nile, right? The Nile is the lifeblood of Egypt. Without the Nile, there is nothing. And even today, and that's why I brought this great satellite picture, Google Earth picture of the Nile. This is a picture of Egypt. Egypt is a massive country. But as you can see from this nighttime picture, the only lights on in the country pretty much are along the Nile, right? And you can see here's the delta where it opens up, but this is all the Nile. People live along the Nile, right? Here's Cairo over here, the big burst of light. They don't live anywhere else. Egypt is a very crowded country, despite the fact that it's a very vast country, because the only way you can live is along the Nile, because everything else is desert. So the Nile provides everything for you. It provides you water to drink. It provides you water for agriculture. When you come and you take away the Nile, what is Egypt if not the Nile, right? And it is not just the most essential thing, it's godlike. So when Paro sees the Nile turns to blood, and what does Paro do? Of course, he goes out to the Nile in the morning, right? Li Oriva Ani Asitini, this is my Nile and I belong to it, right? And it belongs to me and I made it. When he sees the Nile has been turned into blood, this is a very, very disturbing and shocking event for Paro as well as for all the Egyptians. Now, the picture that I brought you here is of a spring in the land of Israel. This is not connected to our Exodus story, but it's important to know. Okay. In the book of Deuteronomy, when Moshe is speaking to the children of Israel in that last year, that final speech, long speech that he makes before he dies, he's giving them a little bit of forewarning what's going to happen to them when they come into the land, right? And he says, the land that you're coming into is not a land like the land of Egypt that draws its water from the Nile, right? The land that you are going into is a land of hills and valleys, okay? Limatar ha-shamayim tishtemayim, you're going to have water from the rain, right? Rain, springs which come from the rain, right? You don't have this constant source of water, which on the one hand is very frightening, right? Because the Nile is always, there's never going to be a time that the Nile is going to run dry. There might be less water, more water, but the Nile is never going to run dry. However, as we know, in the land of Israel, there can be droughts. There could be years that don't have rain. But God says, and whether this is reassuring or more frightening, I'm not sure. He says, the land of Israel is not like the land of Egypt. It's Eretz Asher Hashem Elokecha Doresh Ota Tamid. It is a land that God is always watching, right? If you get rain, and this is a constant refrain in the Torah and in the prophets, if you get rain, it's because you behave properly. If you don't get rain, it's because you haven't behaved properly. There is a causation between your acts and whether you're going to have water. The land of Egypt, there's always water. You don't have to think about it, right? But the land of Israel is a land where you are living under God's watchful eye. Okay, not connected to the Exodus, but a very important point. Okay, we have something that keeps on reiterating over and over throughout the story of the Exodus, and that is that God keeps telling Moshe, it's not going to happen so fast. Don't worry. You're not going to Paro's not going to get off so easy. And I'm going to make him say no, keep on saying no, so that eventually Egypt will be brought to its knees and will be brought to ruins. And it's a very interesting theological discussion. Maimonides talks about how come Paro's free will is taken away from him. That's not what we're going to talk about. You have a different class with somebody else who talks about philosophy. But we are going to talk about the language that's used. Okay? We have two different phrases that are used. One is akshe et lev paro. I will make Paro's heart hard. That makes sense, right? A lev kashe, a hard heart. We say today somebody has a hard heart. But then it says something else. It says achbed et lev paro. I will make Paro's heart heavy. That's a strange phrase. What does it mean to have a heavy heart? Today, when we say a heavy heart, usually means you're worried. Something is, we literally say, is weighing on you. But that is not what it means to the Egyptians. Okay, for the Egyptians, the afterlife, as we're going to see in a moment, is extremely important, right? Life is just a gateway to get into the afterlife where everything is going to be good. But not everybody makes it into the afterlife. How do you get into the afterlife? So the illustration you have here is an illustration from a famous Egyptian text called the Book of the Dead, okay, which talks about, first of all, what you're supposed to do, how you mummify the body, how you take out all the organs, etc., but also what happens after death. And this scene is the scene that's important for us. After you die, your heart is taken out of your body in the whole mummifying process, and it is placed in a container over here. Okay. And then in the afterlife, your heart is put on the scales, right? One of those nice old fashioned scales that we have on our Rosh Hashanah cards. Your heart is put on the scales. Here's your heart on one side. What goes on the other side? This is called the feather of Mat. Okay. Mat is another goddess, and you are weighed against the feather of Mat. If you have been a good person, your heart is very light and you are equal to or lighter than the feather of Mat. You're in, you get into the afterlife. If you have not been a good person, your heart is heavy and you are heavier than the feather of Mat. And what happens to you? You get eaten by the goddess Amit, who is a terrifying combination of a lion and a hippo and a crocodile. So when Moshe says, I'm going to make, God says to Moshe to tell Paro, your heart is going to be heavy. That's basically saying you're going to hell, right? That was what we, how we would translate it today. Right? So Paro's heavy heart is a way of telling Paro, you might think that you're going to get away with what you're doing, but you're not. You're doing something that the gods will not be happy with. Okay. While we're talking about death, first of all, here is Amit getting ready for her dinner of a heart. Now you can see very scary combination of a lion and a hippo and a crocodile. Okay. This is another illustration from the Book of the Dead, but it's just interesting to know, right? The Egyptians have a very interesting belief about the afterlife, which is that you only get into the afterlife from Egypt. If you happen to have the misfortune of dying and being buried outside of Egypt, you're not getting in, right? You're not getting into the afterlife. That's why, as we're going to see, Egyptian governors, it was very hard to get Egyptian administrators to serve outside of Egypt because nobody wants to die outside of Egypt. Now, think about that and think about Jacob, right? Yaakov. He's in Egypt. He's dying. His one last wish to his son Yosef is, Al na tikbereini b'Mitzrayim. Don't bury me in Egypt. I don't want my body here on foreign soil. Bring me back to Kever Avot. Bring me back to Ma'arat HaMachpelah, to where my ancestors are buried. And Yosef has to go to Paro and actually say to him, and you can imagine it's a huge slap in the face, my father doesn't want to be buried here. Your father doesn't want to be buried here? Doesn't he understand this is the only way into the afterlife? And that's why Yosef knows that when he dies, there's no way his brothers are going to be able to take him out. They won't have the clout and the political power. And that's why he says to them, one day, right? Pakod yifkod Elokim etchem. God's going to take you out. One day it's going to happen, and then take my bones with you. But meanwhile, it's not much you can do, right? So that's don't bury me in Egypt. Let's talk a little about bread, because what could be more important on Pesach than talking about bread? Bread is the basic food. This is not only in Egypt. This is in Jewish culture. This is in Arabic culture. Right? Most cultures see bread as the basic food. But in Egypt, it's perhaps even more so. Okay, and you have these great pictures that you have on various tombs and other places of this bread baking industry. Right? Here you have the gathering of the wheat and turning it into flour, right? The harvesting. Here you have the actual baking. Bread is the fuel for the slave economy, right? The Egyptians understand they can't starve their slaves. If you starve your slaves, you don't have any slaves. They die. You have to feed your slaves. You have to feed them relatively well, okay? And what's easy and cheap? Bread, and as we're going to see, beer, okay? So bread is a very much an underpinning for this whole slave system, okay? And even later, by the way, when we talk about the Romans, right? Bread and circuses. But bread is not only that. Bread is also sacred. Right? Your baker's models are buried with you. You can't eat. Think about the story of Yosef. You can't break bread with foreigners. That's something that Egyptians only do with each other. When you leave Egypt, you are also leaving behind Egypt's culture of bread. Right? And part of that culture of bread is being full all the time. Right? That's very hard to do. What God, and we see it, right? We see it with the complaints that Bnei Israel have when they're in the desert. Zacharnu et hadaga, right? We remember all of the good things. V'nochal asher shivtenu al sir habasar ba'ochleinu lechem lasova. We always had enough bread in Egypt. Leaving Egypt is not just about leaving slavery. It's about leaving the culture of slavery. It's about leaving this culture where you might be full all the time, but you have no freedom. You have no higher authority except the Paro. And God says, you've got to leave that behind, because otherwise you're never going to be a free people and you're never going to be able to get the Torah. But it's not a simple thing to do. One of the things that Bnei Israel take with them, right, when they're finally on their way out, right, this triumphant exit, Perek Yud Bet, we know that they carry their dough, right? That we're all familiar with. Okay, they take their dough before it becomes chametz. One of the reasons we eat matzah. Masherotam tsrurot besimlotam al shichmam. They take their masheret. What's a masheret? It seems, according to the plain sense of the text, they're kneading bowls. It's the most essential item in your household. We're not leaving that behind. That's got to come with us. Okay, but it's part of this whole economy and culture of Egypt. And this is where we get to our story of chametz and matzah, okay? Leaving behind the bread of Egypt, okay, we also have to have faith in God. Now, what is a chametz, right? The Torah talks about not using chametz as well as not using something called seor. Chametz is what you see here on the right? What we're all trying to get our out of our pantries. But some of us, this was became particularly popular during the pandemic, have in the back of our refrigerator this nasty looking jar of stuff, okay? And this is called sourdough starter. And this is seor. Okay? Which is more important? Which is more pernicious, the seor or the chametz? The seor. Okay? Chametz, you can have a little bit. Seor, you really can't have almost anything. Okay? You have to get rid of your seor, because the seor is the root of chametz. Now, what is seor? What is starter? Okay? All of the five types of grain that the Gemara talks about have something called gluten in them, right? We're all so much more familiar with these things these days than people were a few decades ago. All of them, if you leave them alone enough, they will rise. They will become leavened. However, at some point a few thousand years ago, somebody probably left some dough over in his bowl, didn't wash out the bowl nicely. And the next day, when he made new dough, that old dough made the dough rise faster. Okay. The starter makes the dough rise faster. It makes the whole process of bread baking much more efficient. And all you have to do is leave over the dough and you can keep a starter for years. There are bakers in Europe who, it seems, keep their starters for centuries, because the more you add to it, the more you feed it, the more it gets old, the better it is. What do you have to do on Pesach? On Pesach, you have to go into the refrigerator, take out that nasty jar, and chuck it in the garbage, right? Think about it. In ancient times today, when we're getting rid of our chametz, right? Here in Israel, most people get rid of all their chametz. We try not to sell any chametz. Hey, we have tons of chametz. We have pasta. I was just looking through my cabinets yesterday. Oh my gosh, how do I have so much pasta? We have pasta and we have cereal and we have pitas in the freezer. They didn't have any of that stuff in ancient times. Nothing lasted. You baked bread every day. What's the one thing you must have? The starter. What's the one thing you must get rid of? The starter. Because you have to have faith that you'll be able to start over again afterwards. And God is saying to you, for this 1 week, get rid of that. Believe in me. Believe that I'm going to give you bread. Leave behind that culture of bread just for this week. And that's what Bnei Israel have to do. Okay, let's get back to our gods. But now let's talk a little bit about the Pesach and Exodus. Okay. Paro says to Moshe, you can, you know, in one of his many iterations of what they should do, don't leave. You can worship your God here in the land. And Moshe says, right, Shmot Perek Chet, it would not be right to do this, for what we sacrifice to the Lord our God is untouchable to the Egyptians. If we sacrifice that which is untouchable to the Egyptians before their very eyes, will they not stone us? Okay? Another ancient god in Egypt is somebody called Amun, and he has a ram's head, a male sheep's head, okay? And you can see two great images here. One is the statue of the god Amun protecting the Paro. Here's a little Paro nestled underneath the chin of the god Amun, okay? Another picture here, you have a the Paro himself giving an offering to Amun, who is sitting on the Paro's chair. Okay. This is an important god. And if you sacrifice it, it's very, very disrespectful. And yet, B'nai Israel have to do that. On the 10th of Nisan, they have to go and they have to take this male sheep, exactly the image of this god, tie it up where the Egyptians are going to see it, right? And you are showing commitment. You have to be willing to put yourself out there. Rashi says that B'nai Israel need mitzvot before they can be redeemed. And therefore, they need to have Dam Pesach and Dam Milah. They need to be circumcised, and they need to give the Passover sacrifice. You need to show that you're in the game. You need to put yourself in danger by going out there and taking this animal that is very sacred to the Egyptians and saying, we're going to sacrifice it. Then you take the blood of the animal, okay, and you use a paintbrush that is made out of something called an azov, okay? An azov is a symbol of humility. It's of purity. You have to put the blood on the doorpost. Is the blood a symbol for the angel to pass over? Is the blood for the outside, right? Or is the blood on the inside? Is it a symbol for you, right? And it's also going to be a nice parallel to what happens when we do the Korban Pesach in the temple, or in the temple years later, in the Mishkan years later, where we put the blood not on the doorpost, but we put it on the altar, right? Same, a similar idea. Okay, one of the very interesting things that the story of the Exodus does not tell us is the name of the Paro, okay? Paro is a generic name. It basically means king, okay? We hear about Paros in other parts of Tanakh. We hear about Paro Necho in the time of Yoshiyahu. We hear about Paro Shishak in the time of Rehoboam. Here we just hear Paro. He's very genetic, right? Or he's a Melech Hadash, Melech Yashan. We have no names. Why? Because the Torah is giving us a message. This guy is insignificant. We're not going to even dignify him with a name. The only one who is the true king is God. However, it is interesting for us to know who this Paro is. So as we said before, the likely candidate is Ramses II, who rules from 1279 to 1213. That's a very, very long rule. Hey, he's a massive builder. He has a new capital that's called P. Ramses, which fits with our cities, right? That the B'nai Israel are supposed to build Pitom and Ramses. We have enormous statues of him, right? You can see over here in the Abu Simbel Temple, in the mortuary, the Ramesseum, the mortuary temple. And he's a very, very powerful king. So he is a good candidate for our story. And one of the most fascinating things that Dr. Joshua Berman talks about, right? He says that, Ramses, has a battle at a place called Kadesh, right, near Syria-Lebanon border of today. It's a massive battle and it's a great victory for Ramses. And because he has this great victory, like we said, kings like to celebrate their victories, he writes an epic poem celebrating his victory, and he has pictures of it all over, you know, on monuments. And this is something that anybody who lived in Egypt would know about. You would either know the poem, or you would have seen the pictures on the Ramesseum. And Dr. Berman talks about how the imagery of the poems is exactly the imagery that is used in Shirat Hayam, okay? Except that instead of Ramses being the divine warrior with the mighty hand and the outstretched arm, it is God. Okay? God is the divine warrior. Susvarachvo Ramabayam is not talking about the Hittites. It is talking about the Egyptians. And God is the mighty warrior and is completely displacing Ramses. And this is a very powerful thing because the Israelites know this poem too, and they're familiar with it too. And then you take it and you say, no, 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 Ramses is not the powerful one. God is the powerful one. Hashem Ish Milchama. It's a very interesting, he has a whole article on it. If people are interested, Google Dr. Joshua Berman and the Song of the Sea. A lot of parallels. I only brought you a very few of them. Okay, we're crossing the sea. Where are we crossing, right? Where do we go? So we talk about the Red Sea, right, which is down here, okay? But it's not such a logical place to cross down here, okay? And there are other choices that are more logical. One of them is, and this is based on an article by Dr. Yoel Elitzur, one of them is all the way up here, which you'll say is not the Yam Suf, but there is a body of water here called the Bardawil Lake. Okay. It is relatively shallow. It has some shallow spots. Okay. It's very muddy. It makes sense that the chariots could be caught in it. Okay. Also, it's a Yam Suf, right? A reed sea. Reeds do not grow by salt water. They grow by lakes. Okay. Yam Suf, is it the Red Sea? Not necessarily. Red Sea, Reed Sea, we say it got confused, but we're not 100% sure that's what we're talking about. So one suggestion is that this is the place where they cross. And then it also makes sense where it says God doesn't take them Derech Eretz Plishtim, which is right up here, but rather takes them south, right? Out of their way. Dr. Yoel Elitzur gives a different suggestion. He sees it as a little bit south of Suez, meaning right over here. That's where they cross, not a very big crossing, right? And what his proof for it is he says that this is a place where there are a lot of different levels in the sea. They're kind of like steps, like, you know, sometimes you can go to the beach, it's very dangerous because it's shallow, 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 and then there's a drop. There are drops like that over here. And that could be exposed by winds and then covered up again, right? So it's kind of taking the story of the Ruach Kadim, the eastern wind that splits the sea and making it into a more natural event. So these are some suggestions about where exactly they cross the sea. And now we're going to take a move from the Exodus for a few minutes and talk about what's happening in Canaan at this time. Okay, so around the 1400s BCE, you have the first really serious Egyptian conquest in Canaan. This guy named Thutmose III, he comes and he takes the very, very strategic site of Megiddo, right? Some people were in the course, remember, we talked about Megiddo as Shlomo's city, as Ahab's city. It controls the Jezreel Valley, this very, very important thoroughfare. This is a picture of Thutmose III vanquishing the Canaanites in the Battle of Megiddo, right? And Thutmose comes along and we have Egyptian rule in the land of Israel, okay? Not only in Megiddo, also in Beit She'an. Beit She'an is a fascinating place. It seems that it is the only city in the land of Canaan that the Egyptians were able to convince an Egyptian to be the governor as opposed to a local Canaanite to be the governor. He got a lot of perks. They built him a beautiful palace, which had all these nice Egyptian statues and pillars and very, 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 very lovely, right? There's also Egyptian remains in Jaffa, right? We have a great story about Thutmose and how he conquers Jaffa by sending his soldiers in. It's sort of like a Trojan horse story, only much earlier, right? Sending his soldiers in as a gift in baskets. They don't know that the soldiers are inside, and then they conquer the city. The remains that we have, archaeological remains, are this gate, right? This is a gate not from Thutmose, but from Ramses. We don't have a lot of archaeological excavations in Jaffa because it's been lived in for many years. But one of the most interesting archaeological remains of this period where the Egyptians are very powerful in the land of Canaan is what we talked about before, these Amarna letters. Okay, so here's Paro Akhnaton, a very kind of regal looking picture of him. And like I said, when the capital is moved from Amarna, where Akhenaton had brought it, and it's moved away, they didn't pack everything so carefully, and they left behind a whole bunch of letters, letters meaning tablets, right? Tablets with cuneiform writing on them, about 300, out of which at least 100 are written by rulers in the land of Canaan to the Egyptian Paro. And they all follow a very set formula. It's a little bit of a humorous formula. What does it say? Oh, Paro, you are the sun and the moon. I fall in front of you. I prostrate myself 7 times, right? They all begin in this very flowery way. And then they say, send food, send soldiers to help us, right? Basically, what happens is that the Egyptians, when they rule in Canaan, there are local rulers, but they are exceedingly dependent on Egypt. And the Egyptians do this on purpose. They don't want the Canaanites to unite and to rebel against them. So everybody is very dependent directly on the Paro and not on themselves and not on each other. Why is this important? Because we have this very strange verse in the book of Exodus where God is telling the people, don't worry, you might be very nervous about going and conquering the land of Canaan. It's going to be okay. Why? V'shalachti et hatzira lefanecha v'gersha et achivi v'et haknani v'et achitim lefanecha. I will send the tzira. Sirah translates literally as a wasp. And it's going to get rid of all of these Canaanites. Now, commentaries like Rashi, they said, there'll be this killer wasp who's going to go and is going to sting people. But what Rashi didn't know, because really he couldn't know, is that when we started to excavate in Egypt and to discover the hieroglyphics there, what we found is that one of the symbols of the Egyptian rulers in Lower Egypt is a wasp, okay? A wasp, a sirah. So what the Torah is saying in the language that B'nai Israel will understand is, I sent the wasp to get rid of the Canaanites, right? It's like you were to say today, I sent Uncle Sam, right? Everybody knew what the wasp was. The wasp is Egypt, Uncle Sam is America. What does it mean? I sent the wasp to get rid of the Canaanites. They don't get rid of the Canaanites, but what they do is they weaken them. And when you read the book of Joshua, you ask yourself, I was just learning this with my son, and he says, well, why don't they get together and beat B'nai Israel? There's so many of them. Because it doesn't occur to them to get together. They've been decentralized for so long. There's a king of Jerusalem, and there's a king of Gezer, and there's a king of Hazor, and each one is his own entity. At most, they combine with a few other local kings, but there's no general centralized government. And that's because the Egyptians did everything they could for 300 years to undermine that. So that's the tzira'ah, and that's why the history of the Egyptians in Canaan is really very important to understand the story of coming into the land. Okay, one or two last things about the time period of Egypt, and then we'll switch to the Seder and talk a little about the Seder. This is the Merneptah Stela. A stela is, as we've seen in other things in this course, the monument that has writing on it. Usually it is about a king's conquests and his victorious conquests. Okay. And this is a stela that is discovered by Flinders Petrie. Okay. Mostly what he does is not to discover really like these treasures, but to really refine the science or create the science of archaeology. But this was a big treasure that he discovered. And of course, it lists, this is from the 1200s, and it lists all of the things that the Paro did. This is from 1213. It's Paro Ramses. And I did this, and I did that, and I did the other thing, right? But here in the hieroglyphics, you have a strange pictogram that you can sound out. Sometimes when you have names, you have pictures that represent sounds. And this sound is Yisrael, Israel. Okay, now what's even more interesting is we have Israel. It's not a person. How do I know it's not a person? Because I have this picture of a man and a woman, and that means a nation. Okay, the nation of Israel, and the rest of it is laid waste. His seed is no more, right? The first time we have the mention of the nation of Israel, we're already off, you know, out of the books. We're not important anymore, right? We don't exist, but of course we do continue to exist, but it's the first time we hear about the nation of Israel outside of the Bible. Okay, one last thing. Book of Joshua tells us that we come into the land, we cross the Yarden on the 10th of Nisan, right? Now, that's a very powerful thing because think back 40 years. On the 10th of Nisan is when we begin begin the process of redemption. That's when we have to take the lamb and show our commitment and get ready for the Exodus. Exactly 40 years later, that is when we enter the land. We also have other parallels to the story of Pesach, to the story of the Exodus. Think about Rahav in Jericho, right? She doesn't put blood on her doorpost, but she puts a red string in her window so that she'll be redeemed, right? Just like Bnei Israel have to put the blood on their doorpost. When they first come into the land, they have to do Brit Milah so that they can do the Korban Pesach. That's the first things, two things that they do in the land. So there are a lot of nice connections between the 10th of Nisan in the Exodus and the 10th of Nisan in entering the land. Okay, let's spend our last few minutes talking about Pesach and Korban Pesach. Okay, the temple is standing, the first temple and the second temple, the focus of Pesach is the Mikdash, right? You didn't stay home and clean. You didn't go to a resort in Arizona. You picked yourself up if you could, and you went to Jerusalem so that you could give the Pesach sacrifice. Okay? And that's what the holiday revolves around. You have Chag HaPesach, right? The sacrifice, the Zevach, and you have Chag HaMatzot, where you eat Matzot for the 7 days. And the Pesach, if you are able to come, is really the commandment. It's the main commandment. The only people today who do the Korban Pesach are the Samaritans on Mount Gerizim. I just gave a whole class about this yesterday, what we can learn about Korban Pesach from the Samaritan Korban Pesach. Many of the things they do are what the Torah says, like every family taking their own lamb, like putting the lambs on a wooden skewer, like cooking them whole like this. Some of the things they do are not the same as what we do, but it's a fascinating connection and parallel to the Mikdash. Another important element of the Seder, of course, is the Maror, right? We want to have Maror because Maror, you know, the Chayenu Miruru, the Egyptians made our lives bitter. The Gemara discusses various possibilities for the Maror. All of them are basically plants that grow wild in the land of Israel. They're kind of endive-like. Today we use the chazeret, right? The romaine lettuce. We'll talk about that in a minute. But all of these, and these are different kinds. This is called the sow thistle, which is actually in Hebrew called maror. This is what the Samaritans use. This is another plant called the harchavina, the irigium criticum. Most of these plants share one quality, which is that in the springtime, when they first start to grow, they're nice and soft and tender and taste not so bad. People actually use these things in salads. But as the summer goes on, they become hard and bitter. And the Gemara talks about that and says it's the same thing. It's very symbolic. The Egyptians, when we first come to Egypt, are very good to us and very soft to us. And as time goes on, they become very hard. Now, many of us on our Seder plate, if not in eating it, have horseradish, have chrain. What the heck is up with that, right? This is clearly not one of the five different kinds of maror that the Gemara talks about. This, by the way, is our chazeret, right? Our chasa. The Gemara also has a nice little pun on that, right? The Hebrew name already in the Gemara is chasa. It says chas Hashem aleinu. God has mercy on us, okay? But at some point, especially, first of all, in the diaspora in general, Jews did not know about these wild plants in the land of Israel. And second, certainly in Europe, Pesach comes pretty early and it's pretty cold and you don't necessarily have wild plants that are starting to grow yet. And already in the 17th century, perhaps even earlier, there's a rabbi named Yom Tov Lipman Heller, the Tosfot Yom Tov. And he says one of the plants of the Gemara list, the tamcha, is actually horseradish root. And that's where we get this idea of horseradish and of crane. It is clearly not what the Gemara is talking about. And today we can go back to the plants that were in the time of the Gemara. Okay, the final thing we'll talk about is misubin, is leaning, right? One of the questions that we have in the Manishtana, right? On this night, kulanu misubin, we are all reclining. What's the idea? Yeah, so for many of us, reclining is you tell the kids to go to their rooms and bring down their pillows. Everybody puts their pillows on their chairs. Some people even like to have cushions on the living room floor. This is not reclining. Okay? Reclining is what they did at a Greek symposium, at a Greek formal meal, which is essentially the model for the Seder. Okay? The Greeks would do this meal where they would sit around for hours on end, lots of eating, lots of drinking, talking philosophy. The difference, of course, being that the Greeks got incredibly drunk and rowdy, and there were orgies and there was throwing up, and the Jews kind of moved it in a holier direction. But the way that everybody sits, as you can see in the pictures here, is you recline. The basic piece of furniture, the most important piece of furniture in a Greek or Roman household is this. It's called a kline. Don't say it looks uncomfortable. Of course, you put some kind of cushion on it, right? It's some form of a couch. And a kline, that's where the word recline comes from. But of course, in the Greek household or in the Roman household, only the important people recline. For the Greeks, only the men. By the time you get to the Romans, it's the women as well. Okay, but take a look at this picture, right? This little guy, he's the servant. First of all, he doesn't get to wear clothes. Second, he's depicted as much smaller. And of course, he's not reclining. The Gemara actually talks about how the servants, they had servants in the time of the Gemara, the servants who are helping to serve the Zevach Pesach or the Seder, they also have to recline because all of us are important on the night of the Seder. Reclining is a sign that you are a free person, okay? The classic living room in ancient times, in Roman times, is called a triclinium because you have three places where you put your klina, right? Your couches, 1, 2, 3. This is from the living room in Sipori. And this is how you set up your living room because this is the way that you eat. If you are an important person, many people ate this way all the time, but on the Seder night, everybody gets to eat this way. Okay, so that's a nice way to connect to the idea of Misubin, that we are going back to the original people who were significant, who were important, and the Jews are saying, no, it's not just those people, it's everybody. Everybody is chashuv. Right? And with that, I believe that we will get to questions. Oops, sorry. All right. First, we just have a beautiful Chag Ha'aviv springtime picture. But let's see what comments and questions people have. Hold on. Let me stop sharing. Hello, everybody. Okay. Let's see what we got here. Okay. Conservative rabbi, yes, we did. If Egypt controlled Canaan at the time of the Exodus, wouldn't the fleeing Israelites be concerned? Yes, they are concerned. That's why we talk about how they don't go derech eretz plishtim. Also, by that point, things are starting to fall apart, right? They're starting to lose their control over Canaan. Wasn't there discovery of Yosef? I don't know. Doesn't mean there isn't, but I don't know. I don't know if anybody else does. The Israelites should not travel by way of the Plishtim, right? Surely the Israelites would be deterred by the threat. Yes, they are deterred by that threat as well as the Plishtim. It seems that it's something that it's a dangerous way to go, right? Derech Eretz Plishtim does not mean they're deterred by the Plishtim. It means that's the way of the Plishtim. And in fact, the Plishtim come into the land around the same time that we come into the land. So they're not going to fight with the Philistines. They're going to fight with the Egyptians. In some tomb scenes, there's a dog. Is it a dog or is it just looks like a dog and it's really this god? I think a jackal, yes, makes more sense. Why did Jacob permit his body to be mummified? Well, he wasn't alive anymore, number one. And presumably, I don't know if the Mefarshim talk about this, but presumably there was not... Yosef couldn't do everything, right? He couldn't stop everything. Because this is his father, they want to give him a lot of respect, and he couldn't refuse everything. There's little, if any, evidence for an influx of people into the land of Israel. Okay, that's a separate question. It's also an important question. What proofs do we have for the Hitnachalut, right, for coming into the land? And archaeologically, by the way, we do have proof. It's not all at once. It's happening over decades, perhaps even centuries, but it is very clear from archaeological surveys that have been conducted in the past, like since the Six-Day War, basically, that you have more and more and more settlements as time goes on. They start very much in the east, right, in the area near the Jordan, and they move west, which makes a lot of sense in the story because that's where they come in from. So we do have evidence. We don't have evidence that, boom, in 1 minute they all settle, but that doesn't contradict the story. Okay, Jacob and the organs, I don't have a good answer. And yes, our burial taboos are nothing like those of the forefathers. This is very true. The Paro did, the Torah doesn't dignify with the name the Paros of Avraham and Yosef. That's true. Wasp. Who's a wasp? Oh, that wasp. Yes. The wasp, who comes up with this idea? I learned it from my neighbor who I think has taught for Torah in Motion, Dr. Benny Gesundheit, who has done a whole research into this, but he is not the first one. There was an Egyptologist named Dr. John Garstang who has written about this. The Phoenicians are not of Greek origin. They are Canaanites. They're basically Canaanites. And then they're indigenous peoples and they move towards North Africa. The Philistines are Greeks. Yes, thank you. Did the Jews continue to make Korban Pesach? That's a very, very interesting question. The Gemara seems to suggest that there were people, like we hear about this guy in Rome, Todros, who makes a gdi mikulas, who makes this kind of a goat in the same way that they made it like the Korban Pesach, right? Did they, and Rabban Gamliel does it similarly, but I would not necessarily say they did a Korban, but they kept on practicing that issue. Okay, Steindl does not like horseradish. Okay. Karpas, you can all talk about your karpas. They're reclining on the right and not on the left. Yes, thank you, Yossi. We recline that way, I believe, because of the Rambam, who talks about how it's not healthy, right? You won't swallow right, you'll choke, if I recall correctly, but I don't know that much about it. Okay, gradual settlement. Yes, thank you. Very nice. Thank you. And I don't know if anybody else has other comments or suggestions. Please feel free to unmute yourself. If you recline right, you can't use your right hand to eat. Also true. All right. I'm not a reclining expert. But thank you. All right. Thank you, everybody. Chag kasher v'sameach, and we will reconvene. I will figure out when. Anyone who has an interesting suggestion for what they want to learn next, feel free to email me. I am happy to hear. I'm not promising I'll do it, but I'm happy to hear.
Excellent. Right. Wonderful. Just to
Thank you. Use some of it at your Seder. I gave you all vorts for your Seder.
Sounds
now you
good.
Can use it.
Thank you.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach. I'm going to end the meeting. Thank you.